Now, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the session on common variable immune deficiency, frequently asked questions. This morning's session is presented by Dr. Charlotte Cunningham Ruddles, Dr. Peter Manning, Dr. Mark Rydell, and Dr. John Routis. So Dr. Cunningham Ruddles is a professor of medicine and pediatrics and immunology at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, New York City. She's also a member of the steering committee and primary investigator for the USIDNet registry, as well as a member of the IDF Medical Advisory Committee. Dr. Rydell is an associate clinical professor of medicine and allergy fellowship program director at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. Dr. Manning is a professor of medicine in the gastroenterology hepatology division of the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He is also the director of the gastroenterology hepatology clinical research program. And Dr. Routis is a professor chief of division of asthma allergy immunology and medical director of asthma allergy clinical immunology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also a member of the IDF Medical Advisory Board. So please join me in welcoming them today.
Okay. So I'll start with, we had some questions that were submitted prior, and it's on genetics, and these are two very related and good questions. What is the proportion of patients with CVID that has a family member with the same diagnosis, and will researchers ever define genetic mutations that cause CVID? And will this assist in monitoring patients and treatment, et cetera. So currently it's estimated about 10% or so of patients with CVID runs in families. We have determined some single genetic causes of CVID, and there's a bit of a debate once you've defined a genetic cause of hypogammaglobulinemia. Do you call it CVID? People debate that issue. I do think it's very important if you do have a strong family history or an unusual manifestation of CVID to look for genetic causes, because we know that it can influence the treatment very much so. And I think now the centers that take care of patients with CVID more and more often are, in particular in the patients with unusual manifestations of CVID, trying to determine genetic causes. And certainly we are taking that approach at our center. So if you know the genetic cause, you're much more likely to be able to come up with a better treatment option, at least in the long haul. Mark?
So I have a few questions here that I'll group for efficiency. These are about sub-Q immunoglobulin treatment. So this question says, what effect does sub-Q products have on a person with diminished kidney function? As you may know and should know, all of the immunoglobulin products do have a warning or a concern about monitoring kidney function. This largely comes from specific products that had a sugar in them called sucrose, where there were some episodes of kidney failure or decreased kidney function. And so that concern has diminished as we have moved away from using those products in large part, although not entirely. So all of the products we do monitor the kidney function. I think that's important. Just with any chronic treatment, you want to make sure that this treatment does not hurt the vital organs and, importantly, the kidneys. There's no data that I'm aware of that suggests that the sub-Q products are at any greater risk for kidney problems. And I think as those of you who were in the session yesterday and have seen some of the data, the sub-Q does often keep the level at sort of a more steady state rather than the up and down that's seen with IV infusions. But it's probably always wise with any of the products to monitor kidney function just because of some of the historical issues. So I don't think there's a major concern with that, but it should be monitored with sub-Q. There's another question that says, does frequency of dose for sub-Q, so weekly versus daily, make a difference when it comes to keeping illnesses at bay? Again, this is individualized. There's no study that's shown that one way in terms of more frequent or less frequent is better in terms of overall infection rate. So the most important thing is to get the dose regularly that you need, that you and your physician think you need to stay healthy and keep the infections away. So it's really personal preference, what works best for you, how often you choose to do it. Again, it's most important to get the right dose and keep your levels where they are to keep you healthy. And there's this concept of the biological trough, which basically means each person's a little bit different in terms of what they need as an IgG level to be infection-free or keep infections reduced. And then finally, there's a question here about an 8-year-old boy that's taking sub-Q. Is it safe to use DDAVP, which is desmopressin, to prevent bedwetting? It should be fine. I'm not aware of any problems with using that medication with sub-Q immunoglobulin.
Okay, so I've got a couple of miscellaneous ones. These aren't really aggregated very well here in terms of what I'm going to talk about, but that's okay because questions come up and they can sometimes be, you know, a little bit on the sporadic side. So here's a question, which is perhaps one that many people have. When we say somebody is a poor pneumococcal responder, what does that mean? And that's the test that we use. The pneumococcal vaccination has been used in the United States and elsewhere in the world for probably 4 to 5 decades now. And it's a vaccination which contains the capsule or coats of bacteria called pneumococci. It's a very common cause of pneumonia. And it's dead. It's not a live bacteria. It just contains the outer coats of that bacteria, the carbohydrates, sugars around it. And the way a person makes an antibody to that is an indication of how well they would do should they see the real bug in real life. And the vaccination is commonly used, and in fact, probably everybody over the age of 65 is going to get it anyway. Healthcare workers, people with asthma, diabetes, chronic disease, get that vaccination because it protects against pneumonia. It's also good for ear infections and nose and sinus infections. And the whole idea is that once having seen that pneumococcal outer coat, one builds up an antibody to it. But we use it also diagnostically to say, would your immune system know what this bug was should it see it again? And so that's the way the test goes. The laboratories have pretty much honed in on a similar number for considering protective response. A good number of people don't respond to every one of the pneumococcal bacteria in the vaccine mix. That's not too uncommon. You don't respond all of them. Most people don't. It's probably genetically driven how that works. And what's meant by a poor pneumococcal response would be a person who has really a very, very, very dim response to that. So if you inject, say, 14 of these vaccine types, that you might respond to only one. I think that would be considered, you know, a pretty bad response. Exactly where great response and where poor response comes in is kind of debated. There's a view that adults under the age of 65 will respond to 70% of them, which is out in the literature. Basically, I think it's crackers. I just think that's ridiculous. Sometime internists are going to have to stand up and rebel because it's just not so. It's just we've given a very high bar, and to me, many people get started on gamma globulin because somebody wrote that down in the literature. That's my opinion. Actually, I'm getting a couple of nods over here, so I'm glad to hear my fellow internists are agreeing with me on this topic because I've sort of felt like a person who didn't agree with the literature makes you feel bad. Okay, so anyway, that's what's a poor responder. Okay, a couple more. What's the life expectancy for a female with CVID? And this has got another paragraph. My daughter was diagnosed, I guess with her immune system was poorly at the age of 2. Then she stopped all treatment at age 10, retested, was positive for CVID. I've heard different things about life expectancy. We did sort of a study on mortality in CVID. It's in the article called Blood. And it seems to me, if you look at all the data for people with CVID, those who have just got infections, respond to gamma globulin, on antibiotics when necessary, as far as I can tell, the data in my registry, which is somewhere around 40 years worth of data, says that the life expectancy is similar to that of age-matched controls. So infection-only phenotype is something which is in that category. There's a question that I just can't answer, but I'm going to say it anyway. It's going to make everybody sad. Private insurance, everyone I know has private insurance blames the Affordable Care Act for increases in insurance premiums, copay. What can we do to put a lid on this rampageous insurance company increases? And I get that totally. I am with you, but I don't know where to put the blame on that one, except that the stuff is expensive and it's hard to make. I get that. On the other hand, why do we have to have the price go up all the time? Sorry, I can't answer that one.
Give you over to Peter here.
Okay, so I have, again, we have a wide range of questions here. There are, I'm going to focus on some of the GI ones. There are two here sort of related to heartburn or gastroesophageal reflux disease. One here says, Nexium Dexilant used for acid reflux gives me diarrhea. What medicines or alternatives will treat acid reflux but will be the least disturbing to the GI tract? Well, you know, there certainly are a number of either proton pump inhibitors or H2 blockers that have different side effects in different people and even certain different efficacy in different people. And there are so many to choose from. I would either choose, say, a different class of medication or just go through different alternatives within those groups. Here's one that says, there's no absorption of iron, vitamin D, or zinc. Tried supplements, both liquid and oral, only absorbs iron via IV infusions. How can we do vitamin D and zinc since pills and diet don't work? Why are absorption issues common in CVID? Well, in general, you know, we're going to have a session on these GI complications of immune deficiencies right after this, and I discuss the non-absorptive enteropathy in CVID that really occurs in just 5 to 10% of people, and it can be quite severe. There's another reason people might get malabsorption. It's a condition called bacterial overgrowth of the small intestine. Occurs in 3 out of 10 CVID patients, and it's not related to that other enteropathy, which is more of an immune-based condition. So my assessment would be to, you know, we have very simple tests to measure the basic global absorption capacity of the small bowels, very simple, called the D-xylus absorption test, and then coupling that with endoscopic biopsies, trying to understand what, if there's some kind of a physical basis for this, and then going ahead to correcting that. Zinc is, you know, magnesium and zinc are sort of in the same family. Magnesium we can certainly give by IM injections, but zinc we typically don't. We typically rely on oral, and the body doesn't need a whole lot of zinc. So typically, while it can be low with malabsorption, as can vitamin D with fat malabsorption, my tact for this would be to try to understand what's causing the malabsorption in the first place. What's the relationship between CVID and the need to have a Nissen fundoplication? So this goes back to this kind of gastroesophageal reflux disease, and a Nissen fundoplication is a surgical procedure where the upper part of the stomach is wrapped around the bottom part of the esophagus to enhance the barrier function so gastric contents don't keep refluxing up into the esophagus. So we got a question about this yesterday, and while I recognize that there seems to be a lot of reflux disease in CVID patients, there is no easy connection between the primary immunodeficiency mechanisms and why somebody would be subject to that. So I just treat it like any other sort of reflux patient, and we go through the workup, looking at how well the esophagus functions as a muscle, and then seeing what the acid output is, even on medication, and sort of as a last remedy, trying to do a surgical procedure to enhance that barrier function. But the short answer is, as far as I know, there's no connection that we can prove between the need for everingness and fundoplication and CVID. Okay, so here's an interesting question. Is IBS with constipation related to CVID? Is there a connection between food allergies and CVID? So, you know, one of the interesting things that's sort of emerged over the last couple of years is the phenomenon of post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome. And this has become such a problem that even the military is very interested in this because of the very long-term consequences, even after diarrheal illnesses for the deployed soldier. There is some immune basis for antibodies being developed against microbial components that actually cross-react with some structural proteins in nerves. And in animal models, it's shown that you can induce motility disturbances and sort of visceral. It's a way that people get more pain at a lower pain thresholds from the GI tract. Make a long story short, there may be a connection, but we're collecting the dots and we haven't connected them yet. So we're not really sure. But I think that that's probably a mechanism because I think that so many people are subject to transient GI infections. Is there a connection between food allergies and CVID? What do you think?
Gluten.
So the thing about gluten is, and you know, I think every CVID patient who's ever been referred to me came with a diagnosis of celiac disease.
Yeah,
and I tell them they probably don't have it. And you know, we can't do the antibody-based testing for celiac in CVID. So basically, I rely on genetic testing. There's an HLA background. DQ2, DQ8, you either have to be a homozygote or compound heterozygote to actually be really at risk to have the full-fledged celiac disease. If you don't have that background, you cannot have celiac disease. So I rely on that. And the flip side of that coin is for every celiac patient who has the proper HLA background and has full-blown celiac disease, there are 50 healthy patients, people walking around with the same genetic background who don't have celiac disease. So, you know, the HLA background is necessary but not sufficient to get celiac disease. So I rarely have had patients who I think might have the CVID neuropathy and they're homozygote for celiac HLA molecules, and I'll put them on a gluten-free diet, treat them like any other celiac patient and see what happens. Often they get better for a short period of time, but the lining of the intestine really never gets better. And to be honest with you, you can look at the biopsies and you can tell the difference. I mean, obviously, a CVID patient's not going to have a lot of plasma cells in the biopsy, but there are other features like CVID patients are going to have a lot more changes that you just don't see in celiac disease. So there are some other clues.
Good. That's good. That was a good tip. I'm just going to give a couple of questions. One is one I actually got by email not very long ago. You know, we're changing the coding in the United States, the way that diagnoses are allocated to insurance companies for payment. So this question was, is there any reason why IVIG would not be medically necessary for a CVID with predominant T-cell immunoregulatory defect, which is the new ICD-10 code 83.1. I don't know if you know this or not, but it was a ridiculous overhaul that immunologists had no input on. And if a person has CVID, that means they have an antibody deficiency, and that would be proven in the chart, and the gamma globulin levels would also be low. And so there can hardly be an insurance company who would not allow gamma globulin to be given. But I realized there must be some anxiety about this because I got this question already by email, and some insurance company may try an end run saying if it's a T-cell thing, why are you on gamma globulin? So we may have a teeny battle on our hands on that one. There shouldn't be, but that's it. If a grandfather has MS, would it be connected to a grandchild's specific antibody deficiency? I have to give that a no. Is there any protocol for a 15-year-old with regards to gene therapy? We don't have gene therapy in CVID because we don't know the gene in most cases, and even for the extremely small exceptions that Jack was alluding to a minute ago, about some 2 or 3 or 4% will have a gene you can put your name on. We don't have gene therapy protocols for any of those. And by the way, we probably then would not call that CVID anymore. We would end up saying it's the name of that gene like we do for everything else, and then there might be another way to treat that disease, but I don't think that would involve gene therapy. Why is bone marrow transplant not an option? Of course, we would love, love, love to have everyone's bone marrow fixed. But I think, as Mark was saying yesterday, the study from Freiburg had a 50% mortality in the first 2 years. 50%. So, and those were patients who were in very, very, very bad medical condition. Yes, they had 50% survival, but 50% mortality, would you be willing to have your 15-year-old have a risk of 50-50 not being alive in 2 years? You know, we're not there yet, bottom line. Why don't we move along?
I have a few more here about immunoglobulin treatment, so I'll buzz through those. What effect does IVIG and sub-Q have on liver function? For the most part, there haven't been any major issues with the liver and immunoglobulin therapy. Recall this is a blood product, so there's always a theoretical risk of something like a viral hepatitis, but that's not been an issue for quite a number of years with all the testing and purification that goes on with these products. So in my own patients, we do monitor their liver function periodically, but that's not a side effect to have major concerns about with the treatment. This one says, my doctor won't let me switch to sub-Q because he's concerned about my reaction to meds, welts, and my site's not healing properly with some bruising and skin healing issues. I have terrible side effects with IVIG. What are your thoughts? Well, these are difficult questions, and I think in my experience, most patients can tolerate sub-Q unless they really have major local site problems with infection or skin healing. The site reactions, the local reactions, are generally not a major problem. They can be uncomfortable, but they're not a sign, usually a harbinger of worse things happening down the road. So usually local site reactions at the infusions for sub-Q can be managed with supportive measures, and I think if IVIG is intolerable due to the side effects, then that's something that should certainly be explored. There are cases where you really, I say, stuck with IVIG, and if the sub-Q really is not working well, then there are a lot of pre-treatment protocols that can be tried to try to reduce the side effects. But this is a hard question. This just has to be worked through for each patient, and hopefully you can find a physician that will be willing to work with you on that. There's a couple of questions here about the once monthly sub-Q, and I'm not going to use brand names in here. I'm not here to promote anybody specifically, but as you may be aware, there is a method now to use sub-Q immunoglobulin once a month. This is coupled with an enzyme, and there's a question here about how this works. How does once monthly sub-Q work? The enzyme that's used with the immunoglobulin is called hyaluronidase. This is an enzyme that basically opens up channels in the sub-Q tissue temporarily to allow the fluid, the immunoglobulin fluid, to spread out under the sub-Q tissue. And what that allows you to do is infuse much more volume and a much higher dose at a single spot one time a month. So at least in the studies for this approach, patients were able to do a whole monthly dose, however many grams they need, once a month, sub-Q at one spot, using this enzyme technology to sort of spread that fluid out in the tissues. So that's how it works. It is approved by the FDA. It's the newest way to do treatment, along with the more conventional sub-Q and with IV. There's a question here about, is monthly sub-Q a long-term therapy solution for CVID patients? All we can say there is that the studies so far show that it's safe, that it works, that it's approved by the FDA. Those study patients have been followed for a little over 3 years now, and so far so good. So that's about as much long-term data as we have with this approach, but there have not been any major issues. So all I can say is time will tell, but this is working well for some patients.
I had several questions about the lung, and so I thought we had questions that were previously submitted, and I thought I would just try to answer those questions all at once. What is the proportion of patients with CVID that have lung issues? And, you know, it varies according to study from study, but it sort of depends on how hard people look. I would say, in general, some lung problem, probably, you know, at least 50% of patients with CVID have something. It may not be serious. It may be asthma or something along those lines. But again, it depends on how hard people look, whether or not they've had, for example, a CT scan of the chest or other diagnostic studies. And is it possible to determine if a patient with no current lung issues will develop lung disease? And unfortunately, there's no current way to determine that. And as you know, when we give gamma globulin, we're just giving the IgG form. And so many of our patients don't make IgA with CVID, so it's certainly possible that one could develop lung disease. I think that the hope is, with an early diagnosis and an absence of lung disease, that the proper dosing of gamma globulin along with other measures that we would take would prevent lung disease, but that's currently not proven. And then there's a series of questions related to, you know, different conditions in the lung. One concerns asthma and reactive airways disease, and physicians typically put those together. We say, and asthma is basically a condition that can occur in CVID or in other people. It's not necessarily connected to CVID, and it refers to a problem where patients have difficulty getting air out. Therefore, it's called an obstructive lung disease. But unlike things like emphysema, there are medicines that are effective at treating it and at least reversing some of the obstruction. So, you know, to treat asthma depends on the severity of asthma, and there's a variety of issues that go into that. So I won't talk about, you know, how you would treat it, but we think that we, in general, have pretty good medicines for asthma. The other question is recurrent infections in the lung. And all I would say is that when you have a pneumonia and CVID, the doctor needs to make sure that they're aware of all the different common bacteria and other organisms that can cause infection. It's not the same list as a person that has a normal immune function. There's a question on granulomatous and lymphocytic interstitial lung disease. How do we best treat it? No one really knows how to best treat that disease. There's some studies, including ours, that suggest maybe a combination of immunosuppressive medication can really work quite well to improve lung function and clear the disease. So I think that that's an ongoing area of research. The one thing I will say is, at least in our experience, we haven't found that steroids in the long haul can clear the disease. And then finally, a really important another question on the lung about bronchiectasis. And the studies suggest that bronchiectasis is the most common complication in the lung in CVID that's really significant. And bronchiectasis just means widening, abnormal widening of the airways. And what happens is when we get recurrent pneumonias, that inflammation, those white blood cells that go to fight the bacteria, actually damage the airways and cause the airways to become ectatic or wide. Once they become wide, they often lose the cilia and they can't clear the stuff that we inhale day in and day out, and it predisposes that part of the lung for more infection. And so there are a number of methods to try to improve the bronchiectasis. If it's found early, we know that it can actually heal on its own if we can prevent infection. We also know from studies that if you have bronchiectasis, you're going to probably require a higher dose of gamma globulin to remain infection free, so that's an important thing to know. And then finally, it's really important to try to, what we call, mobilize the secretions and get the mucus out of those affected areas of the lung. And there are a variety of methods to do that, but when I gave my talk yesterday, one method I'd like to say is just aerobic exercises. Just getting up and really moving and doing exercises is a very efficient way. And then there are other tools that we have to mobilize secretions. In severe forms of bronchiectasis, where the lungs have been irreparably damaged, sometimes we will put patients on prophylactic antibiotics, and so that's another method. So I think that answers most of the questions that I saw related to the lung.
So we have a couple more GI questions. There's a question here, are colonoscopies for CVID patients, other suggested testing or biopsies that a GI doc should do or look for during colonoscopies, endoscopies, for instance, Peyer's patches? So Peyer's patches, you know, a collection of what we call gut-associated lymphoid tissue. Peyer's patches are actually found in rodents, and we have they're secondary lymphoid nodules that we have. Sometimes they're age appropriate. You can see them, particularly in young people or in their teens and 20s, that are normal. But the short answer is no. There's no routine endoscopic procedure that a CVID patient needs to go through. But if there are GI symptoms, particularly related to concerns about malabsorption or chronic diarrhea, then even if through the endoscope things look normal, it's always critical to get plenty of biopsies for the pathologist and the doctor to review, because just looking at it doesn't tell you what's going on beneath the surface. Do any certain foods carry more bacteria than another, and does any food carry more danger than another? So, you know, I think that it's likely that CVID patients may be more susceptible to what we, you know, call pathobionts, or these organisms can actually act as pathogens. But, you know, other than what anybody else would be susceptible to in terms of foodborne illness, so-called food poisoning, or other kinds of infectious diarrheas, including like norovirus, There's no food, particularly for a CVID patient, that they need to avoid because of infection. And obviously, everyone needs to observe the 5-second rule. Do multiple antibiotics hurt your immune system, or does it help a lower immune system patient? And then there's a related one. When a patient with CVID is having recurrent infections, what would be the rationale behind continuing treatment with only prophylactic antibiotics, especially in the face of consequential GI complications? So having spoken with you all for a couple years now, I used to get a lot of questions about probiotics, and so I actually included in my GI talk a section on the gut microbiome and what we know about it and effects on antibiotics. And I think it's true that chronic antibiotic use can actually irreversibly change a person's gut microbiome. Whether that's for the better or for the worse, or there's no difference, we don't know, because nobody has actually looked. When I think about the use of antibiotics now, I'm actually very gun-shy with my patients because not only, at least in patients I see with a high rate of C. difficile colitis, this antibiotic-associated colitis is what I like to avoid, but we really don't know what the gut microbiome looks like in groups of patients who've had chronic exposure to antibiotics, but I can guarantee you it doesn't look like what they started out with. But we don't know what its genetic makeup is, its metabolic activity is, and we do know that if there's what we call a dysbiosis, something that looks very different from, quote-unquote, a healthy gut microbiome, that can contribute to other kinds of conditions, including metabolic syndrome, obesity. We mentioned post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome, but also kind of chronic states of inflammation. And I think it's probably going to be kind of a next phase of looking at or research into, say, the concomitant consequences of immunodeficiency. But in terms of antibiotics, I think that you prioritize the need. You don't worry about sort of the side effects. If you need them to treat an infection, then you need them. And your clinician is going to be the one who's going to decide the risk and benefit. Because I tell my IBD patients, they're worried about going on Remicade. Okay, I said, well, that's fine. I said, let's talk about it. What is the risk of not being on the medicine versus the risk of being on the medicine? And that's sort of a question you also have to address. We have a couple of questions about associated GI conditions. Is achalasia related to my CVID, and are there any gallbladder connections between CVID and IVIG? So, to be honest, there's really no solid connections between CVID and these two conditions, to be honest. You know, achalasia, for people who don't know, is the loss of motility in the smooth muscle portion of the esophagus, the bottom two-thirds. It can be a result of a parasite infection called trypanosomiasis that's endemic to South America and Central America, or it can be an autoimmune disease. It's easy to diagnose. It's not so easy to treat. But there's really no connection, except for the fact that, you know, against all odds, there are autoimmune complications of CVID, a lot of times, again, against all odds, antibody-mediated. But as a gastroenterologist, we don't consider CVID a risk factor for achalasia. The gallbladder disease is sort of the same story. We don't consider CVID a risk factor for gallbladder or biliary tree complications, except, well, not... If, for instance, somebody has an autoimmune anemia and that anemia is related to rapid destruction of red blood cells, sometimes you can get a lot of the byproducts of that destruction can contribute to gallstone disease. It's not a concern in this question, but that possibly could be related to gallstones. Okay, thanks.
There you go. Sorry, I'll just give it to you. They just
did
it for themselves.
And there's a question here. Are studies on nutrition, like special diets, do they help with CVID? And the short answer there is no. We're looking to buy a house and our son has CVID. Should well water versus city water be a limiting factor in our search? Are there any precautions we should take with well water? You know, I think we talked about this yesterday a little bit. There was a concern about water and pathogens. I think every water supply, city or well, is going to have some kind of microorganisms in it. My advice would be not to get too crazy about it, but if for some reason there's some unexplained diarrheal illnesses, you could always filter your water, and you have to, all bacteria can be filtered by a 0.2 micron filter. That's what we use in the lab to sterilize medium and things like that. So 0.2 microns, that's the key, okay?
Okay, I'm gonna go to another topic. This is the question about lymphoma and malignancy, and these were previously submitted, but I know everybody has certain questions, and so let's think about some of those things. So what proportion of patients with CVID develops lymphoma and or a malignancy? I think that lymphoma runs in the European group somewhere around 4%, 3%, 4%. of patients with CVID who managed to get into the registry. The problem with the recent ESID registry data on a great number of patients is the data is not very rich. In other words, they've entered a lot of patients, but there's not very much data behind every entry, and so I don't know whether it's totally accurate or not. So that might be something of an overcall or an undercall. I'm not sure. My own data, I have confessed freely, I think is a little over the top. I started to collect information on this when I was at Sloan Kettering in New York, and obviously that means that I only see certain patients and it might have been skewed. So lymphoma does happen in CVID. In some cases, and in fact the majority of the cases that I have seen, they're actually quite low grade. And I have had two patients that had no treatment for somewhere around 8 or 10 years just because that lymphoma wasn't going anywhere. It was what's called a maltoma. In other words, a mucosal-associated, highly differentiated cell that didn't require any treatment. So sometimes they simply don't need anything except monitoring. There have been other malignancies, of course. I think, you know, we all do see the ordinary cancers that develop in everybody. One concern I think people have when they have CVID and then they have some sort of need for chemotherapy is, well, God, how will I do? In my experience, people with CVID do just absolutely fine with chemotherapy. Yes, you have to take your gamma globulin and make sure your levels are decent, but in my experience, people go through this therapy incredibly well, and I always tell anyone on the oncology service, do what you normally would do and don't do anything else, and it seems to be a pretty good way. What other tumors? In the literature, gastric cancer is somewhat increased in CVID as well. I actually dispute those statistics currently. I think that we're rather influenced by the previous times. And H. pylori, which is one of the major contributors of gastric cancer, seems to be not common in CVID at this stage of the game, perhaps because we use antibiotics just a lot, and it could be that we've more or less removed that issue. So when I reviewed the literature recently and in our data, the old numbers were much higher than the current numbers in the United States. So yes, it's important, and yes, I do think about it. But in the absence of vitamin B12 deficiency or lack of gastric juices, in other words, achlorhydria, where there's not enough acid in the stomach, I think that that's not something that I give a great deal of thought to anymore. So repeated endoscopies are not something that I think is appropriate for our patient group. And I think those are the malignancies that are commonest. We seem to have a slight excess of skin cancers, basal cell, squamous cell, and perhaps even melanoma. Okay, well, melanoma, you know, everyone has to stay out of the sun these days, which, as my population is aging, most of us didn't stay out of the sun as we were youngsters either, so it could be that will change over time. So I think that's the story. Oh, there's one other thing, and it did come up in one of the questions as well, and that is that how do you screen for lymphoma? The bottom line is you can't, so let's forget that it's possible. I don't think anybody wants to be getting CTs periodically or MRIs. PET scans I find remarkably hard to interpret in CVID with that regard. If there's a strong suspicion of it, it could be an ancillary help, but getting intermittent PET scans will drive the healthcare bill up. And I think it does very little for anything except say, oh my, there's a node, go look at it. And one does, and it turns out to be lymphoid hyperplasia like they always are. So I don't think that continuous screening is good. The patients that I've had who've had lymphoma, of which I've now seen 40, have been found almost in obscure ways. Once on a mammogram, several in the parotid, a few in the lacrimal gland, a couple in the chest, a few in the abdomen, one in the inguinal node. Generally, they're not in the normal places. So even though your doctor may be thinking they're looking hard, let's just be honest, there's really not a good way of doing really screening. If a node develops, if something changes, then that's the time. And by the way, they're not associated with fever as far as I can tell. Most of these are pretty asymptomatic. So what you do is you just continue your normal medical care, and then if there's something pops up, then you get it biopsied. And that's, I know, not comforting, but let's try to stick to the facts where we can on that. The standard of care for testing, somebody asked, for a patient that I just see who I think is doing well, or maybe I'm not certain they're doing well. What kind of standard testing do I do? I do immunoglobulin levels at least every 6 months. And when they come to me and get infused in our area, we do a CBC usually at least once per year. You could do it every 6 months. We also do a chemistry screening panel at least once per year, sometimes twice a year, but generally I think once a year does it for most of these patients. Chest x-ray at baseline, no one can argue with that. I don't do routine chest x-rays periodically. Jack, I'd love to know what your routine is for looking at x-rays, but the thing is, x-rays don't really tell you a lot because you're not seeing what you want to know. Spirometry, I do spirometry, but I don't find spirometry tells me as much as the diffusion capacity of the lung. But those are patients that I already know have something wrong with their lung anyway, and I'm just following what's going on. MRI of the lung has not panned out as good as CT, I think, Jack. I'm going to get Jack's opinion on that. MRI of the lung for follow-up.
The MRI, which does not use any radiation at all, looks very promising. And there's some studies to suggest that although it's not quite as good as CT scan of the chest, it's pretty good. The problem with MRI is that not all centers will do it or know how to do it properly for the chest. And there is a larger cost associated with the MRI, and then in particular for young kids, because it takes much longer to do the MRI, you're actually in the machine much longer, the children would likely have to be sedated. But for an adult, it looks like a very promising alternative.
Hey, this is a really lovely question. I just adore this question. I don't know who asked it, but it's really smart. Why can't infusions of IgA or IgM be given? Great question. As you know, your IgA and your IgM is not in that gamma globulin solution, so this is a very logical question. Okay, two answers. One is if you gave IgA by vein, it doesn't do anything except stay in the vein, and it doesn't go out to your mucosal tissues, because IgA that's secreted has this amazing routine of being made locally and exported locally. And the IgA in your serum is not the same thing as the IgA in your mucosal secretions. So it doesn't get out of the system into the place where you want it to be, number one. And so what about IgM, for that matter? IgM doesn't know anything that IgG doesn't know, so that's one thing. Number two is that if you give IgM, it just loves to stick together. It's a very sticky molecule. It's five times as large as the IgG molecule, and it likes to just aggregate. And so that means that you're going to get probably infusion reactions. And as I say, since IgM doesn't know anything IgG doesn't know, you don't get much bang for your buck there. One more that's in my hand here. What specific information does genetic testing give you with regarding to a CVID patient with severe complications and autoimmunity? I think that goes back to Jack's comment a while ago. If you have a diagnosis of CVID, and it's a young person, perhaps, with a lifelong history of severe autoimmunity, that might be the time to think, is this one of the other small subset of patients who can have a gene that is different, and that's leading to both the hypogammaglobulinemia and the autoimmunity. So a little bit more testing in such a patient might be worthwhile. We're on the verge of being able to do this better. So what would that do? It might tell you a better treatment. There are several different treatments that might be used if you knew it was one gene or the other. But let me just give you my overall, and that is that rituximab has been remarkably successful in CVID treatment. I think Mark mentioned this yesterday as well, which is that for severe autoimmunity, this is the last thing a hematologist thinks of with regards to CVID, but it's now become the first thing I think about, because we can replace your gamma globulin by the treatment that you're getting, and I don't care if your B cells go to sleep for a year, just kind of taking a hike for a bit and stop being so autoimmune, and I think it's helped us just enormously. Has a real handful here.
Yeah, I'll trade you. Okay. Take those top three.
All right, I have a potpourri here. I think I was handed this question because I live in California. Is there a place for medical marijuana in the treatment of CVID? I claim no expertise in this, but I don't know. There's no studies looking at this, of course, and as you all know, medical marijuana has made lots of claims to be able to treat lots of things. I do have a few patients that have reported to me that they find it helpful. The interesting thing is when I press them to ask them how it really helps, they will admit that it probably doesn't really help with their symptoms, but they just don't care that much anymore. I will make one comment, though, because I think it is important to consider health-wise. There is literature showing that smoking marijuana is horrible for your lungs. In fact, there's some data to show that smoking a single marijuana cigarette is equivalent to smoking several tobacco cigarettes because of the all the particulates and chemicals that come along with that. So in my patients who feel strongly about doing this, I tell them, do not smoke it, take it some other way if you find that that's something you need. So I think, I mentioned this also yesterday, smoking is one of the, of course, the worst things you can do for your health, but with PID, it's even magnified further because of all the lung problems. So if you choose to do this, which I'm not advocating, but don't smoke it. There's a couple questions here about NK cell deficiency, and I'll give my view on this, and there's certainly people at this meeting who know much more about NK cell deficiency than I do, but there's a question about where do NK functional deficiencies fit in, especially if that's all you have on laboratory testing, and there was another question about low NK cell numbers on repeated testing, and does this affect the immune system? So my own bend on this is that most NK cell deficiency testing is done by people who don't really know what they're looking for. And I think, you know, I get a lot of people coming in with labs showing their NK cells are low, but they're otherwise relatively healthy people. What we do know about NK cell deficiency, these people who have true NK cell deficiency are very, very ill most of the time from specific types of viral infections, and it's a family called herpes virus infections. I have seen a few of these people in my career, and they are not subtle. They are very, very sick in the hospital, usually with disseminated viral infections. So we know those people certainly have a problem where the NK cells are extremely important, and if they're missing, these viruses take over. My own opinion, and the other people can weigh on on this, is if you're not seeing that picture, if you're not seeing these overwhelming viral infections with specific types, that the NK cell function is probably not that important overall. NK cell testing is very tricky. It's very susceptible to lots of things like temperature changes, activity, even how much sleep you've gotten the night before can affect these sorts of tests. So I think that this is a case where the data is sometimes overinterpreted and sort of sold as something that's, you know, not likely to be that clinically important in most cases. The other issue is we have very little that we can do about that, even if that's a problem in terms of replacing NK cells or augmenting them somehow. So if you guys feel differently, please, but that's my view of it.
I think none of us are experts on NK, and no doubt there probably are NK defects, but I really only know one person in the United States who's really thinking about it seriously. I think it's because it's turned out to be an incredibly difficult task. So my bet is that the common garden variety tests that you can get from the labs actually are not helpful. Yeah?
A couple other questions here about specific clinical scenarios. Is there any way to preventatively treat a child with CVID if there's a whooping cough outbreak in school? So whooping cough is caused by a bug called pertussis. Generally speaking, immunoglobulin has good levels of pertussis because, well, at least historically, everybody got vaccinated against this. This is part of the problem is people aren't getting vaccinated, so we see outbreaks. But the answer to this really is, if in CVID, is make sure you're doing your immunoglobulin, make sure you're doing your treatment. That should provide you a very good level of protection against this pathogen. And then, of course, if a child starts to get symptoms, to treat very early and be aware that the treatment is required. A question about a girl that's 3 years old. She's had recurrent ear and sinus infections that are hard to treat. She's sick several months out of the year. This has been blamed on allergies by her pediatrician, and she's also showing some signs of juvenile arthritis, but testing negative. We have a history of CVID. Should that be explored for her? I would say absolutely. Any child that's sick more often, and sounds like this little girl's sick quite often, I would send the tests. I think it's not difficult to test. Check the immunoglobulin levels, and you'll have your answer for that.
Okay, my son has CVID and bronchiectasis with lymphadenopathy. He's had 3 lymph nodes in the neck removed, another one in the groin. Should they continue to remove the enlarged lymph nodes? No. and was told that they're precancerous, lymphoid nodular hyperplasia. So let me just say, you know, as Charlotte brought up, in talking about lymphoma, yeah, there is an increased risk of lymphoma. In every high-grade lymphoma, in other words, a serious lymphoma, the patient was sick and you knew it. It wasn't something that crept up on you. And we also know that patients with CVID, a subgroup, have problems with what we call lymphadenopathy. In other words, their lymph nodes are enlarged. And just to recurrently biopsy those nodes, I think, isn't indicated. If there's something else going on, the node is really weird. And, you know, for example, the son or daughter is losing weight or has night sweats or something else to make you think it's serious, then you would go ahead and biopsy it. But other than that, I would just find out how are you doing and, you know, and sort of monitor those much more conservatively. There was a question about CVID in pregnancy, and would a genetic test be required to determine or predict the possibility of having a child with an immune defect? And I think the short answer to that is currently no. We don't routinely check for genetic causes of CVID in women that want to become pregnant. Again, you've heard the estimates on how often it's familial. And, you know, everyone probably has a little different advice to tell parents that have CVID about their children. And what I say is, you know that you have CVID, and a small proportion of patients, it's familial. So, you know, just alert your pediatrician, and if the child has really what seems to be an increased number of infections, there's an incredibly simple test to make the diagnosis of CVID. So I just think, you know, a common sense approach for this, it's unusual to have a familial predisposition to CVID. There was a question about pandas. Is there a relationship between pandas and CVID? And the answer is no.
Not the animals.
This is a an auto-inflammatory condition that generally children get. It's a bit controversial, and I don't want to spend too much time on it. And then there's a going back to the flattened villi, is there any treatment to help stimulate flattened villi? My son is 4 and sounds like is having a problem, you know, maybe with good nutrition and absorbing, and I'll go back to the answer previously. It's important to try to figure out why those villi are flat and then to treat the source of the problem. So, but there isn't anything specific that we can get to stimulate villi. And then another question relates to, I was first diagnosed with CVID and then CID. You know, should we look for a genetic cause? Is the treatment the same? So this gets sort of confusing. Common variable immune deficiency, the typical cases of common variable immune deficiency we think of as predominantly an antibody problem. Although we know that when we look for problems in other components of the immune system, we frequently can find some abnormality. For example, a significant proportion of patients with CVID, you know, might have subtle T-cell problems or not so subtle T-cell problems. Combined immune deficiencies are typically considered when, you know, there's both a significant problem with antibody and a significant problem with another part of your immune system, typically, you know, T cell. And so that's, you know, if you have a combined immune deficiency, okay, it raises the issue of whether or not it was CVID to begin with, and it would really depend on the individual case. So for example, in a young child who was diagnosed with quote-unquote CVID and maybe was referred to a different center and they found really, really low T-cell counts, under those circumstances, yes, I think you know, trying to determine if there was a genetic cause would be really important. On the other hand, if you're 55 years old and have had CVID for 20 years and your T-cell count's a little low, no, I wouldn't under that circumstance. So every case is different, and you just have to use some common sense in making a decision on when to look for genetic causes, at least at this point in time.
So just a comment on the villi issue. You know, at the session we did yesterday, and I'll repeat right after this, I have a case report of a patient we treated at NIH who, you know, had no villi. And this is we studied the enteropathy in CVID, and we studied the types of inflammatory chemicals, cytokines that were being made by the T cells in the inflamed tissue, and found that they were really a very dramatically increased in these cytokines that drive a reaction called a Th1 reaction. And you know, Dr. Rundle's confirmed the same thing when looking at the peripheral blood profile, but this is right in the tissue. And it's very different from Crohn's, where you get Th1 plus Th17. It was just IL-12 and gamma. So we actually treated this person with an experimental drug that was, it was an oral drug from a company called Cinta Pharmaceuticals in Massachusetts. And it was aimed at blocking these types of cytokines. And in fact, this woman had regrowth of her villi, and we normalized her steatorrhea, her absorption. But I will say that short courses of corticosteroids, some types of oral immunosuppressants or immunomodulators like azathioprine, people in literature reports of treating the enteropathy with anti-TNF-alpha drugs like Remicade and Humira, they can have an increased risk. But I think that as there are new emerging drugs, something like Xeljanz, which could possibly maybe be used off-label, you know, in blocking cytokines, or Stelara, which actually targets IL-12, but also IL-23. The difficulty is going to be getting to administer a drug like this that clearly has a specified infectious risk in a patient who already has a primary immunodeficiency. But I think in certain circumstances, we have to think outside the box and be able to try to manage those risks. Those are two kind of examples.
How are we doing?
Well, we're out of time.
Okay.
We don't have a week.
Okay. Well, this drug, we were using it in a specific, it was not approved by the FDA, so it was, as a lot of these drugs go, not developed, unfortunately. But.
Yeah. Out of time.
Wow. I think we wrote two textbooks this morning. We have more questions than we have time to answer. I apologize for not getting to all of them. We will collect them and hopefully through some means, IDF can get answers out in the newsletters or in other other methods. So, but I'd like to thank our panelists today. It was a wonderful round of questions.